Good morning, everyone, Your Eminence. It's hard not to just hark back to the saint of the day, Saint Isidore of Pelusium, for a very famous quote that I'm sure most of you know, but if there's even one person who doesn't know it, I mean, it merits repeating. Despite the fact that he was an Alexandrian for the most part, and am I audible? Or okay, do what you need to do. Despite the fact that he was an Alexandrian and in the circles of the patriarchs of Alexandria, who were no great friends to St. John Chrysostom, Isidore of Pelusium was a friend and a supporter of St. John Chrysostom, and actually reprimanded Cyril of Alexandria for his refusal to include Chrysostom in the diptychs. That's another story. But in one of his letters, I forget which one, because I think they said there were, was it 4,000, 5,000, 10,000, or very large body of correspondence. He made the following remark, which sort of, as the Greeks would say, aphisepohi, I mean, it's just this very famous thing. And he says that, it'll be well known to most of you, I think, that stoma Christou Pavlos, stoma Pavlou Chrysostomos, right? That the mouth of Christ is Paul, and the mouth of Paul is Chrysostom, right? Stoma Christou Pavlos, stoma Pavlou Chrysostomos. And of course, this is also around the time where there's the tradition of St. John Chrysostom and his disciple Proclus. And while Chrysostom is locked in his study preparing his sermons, his disciple Proclus hears whisperings coming from inside the study and is a little perplexed by this because there's not supposed to be anybody else in there. And he begins to peer through the keyhole and he sees an individual leaning over the desk of St. John Chrysostom and whispering into his ear. This goes on for a few nights until he actually sees an icon of St. Paul and realizes that the person whispering into St. John Chrysostom's ear is in fact St. Paul. So we have this tradition that St. Paul was the one who interpreted his own works in a sense for St. John Chrysostom, and hence the quotation that I shared with you. having thought about the six talks that I'll be doing over the next few days, I decided to change the content of what I came to say is the same. That'll be unchanged, but I've rearranged it a little bit in light of the structure and the order. The first talk, which we'll get into in a moment here, is the same. And there is a, before I forget to mention it, there's a one-page bibliography, which is for your records. You'll see that it has to do with what I'm talking about here, and anybody who's interested in further reading on this subject has that bibliography. I haven't read everything on that list, but I've probably read maybe 80 or 90% of it, and I can recommend those books very highly. Okay, so the first talk here of the series is basically called Distractions. Right? Talk about distractions today. Before we can talk about deeper things, before we can talk about the life of prayer, we need to talk about what it is that prevents us from having a life of prayer, one of the major obstacles that's in our path is the whole phenomenon of distractions. I heard some years ago in Greece, I heard somebody say something that was quite, I'm gonna just move this here, that was quite memorable. I won't say it in Greek, I'll get right to the English, that every depth has a surface. Every depth has a surface, but not every surface has a depth, right? And this is why we should not pay attention so much to surface appearances, but we should always strive to pay attention to the depth of things. And I think this is especially important for us. I don't mean to offend American culture, but I see our culture becoming increasingly superficial, right? We've lost the sense that there is a tremendous depth to life and to the human person. And everything has become very shallow and very superficial, and we're now just sort of seduced and bewitched by superficial surface appearances. And it's all the more remarkable that people like us should have been seduced by surface appearances, because I think in the history of civilization, there have been no greater or more sophisticated viewers of images than the Byzantines, than the Orthodox, right? Of all the peoples who have ever lived, I mean, the Byzantines or the Orthodox were the most intelligent and sophisticated viewers of images. We live in a society saturated by images now, right? But yet we're not very sophisticated or critical viewers of them. We tend to be sort of bewitched or distracted or, right, by any fleeting, passing image, and there are thousands of them all over the place. So every depth has a surface, but not every surface has a depth, which is why we shouldn't allow ourselves to become fixated on surfaces, but attend to the depths of things. However, attending to the depth of things, or to the depths, is not easy, right? Attending to the depths is not easy because we have a problem. We have a problem that prevents this from happening. I mean, the mind of man, as we currently know it, is a thing that is disordered. It is a thing that is confused, right? The mind is something that we find it hard to focus, right? We find it hard to focus. And we are easily prone to distractions, right? So if this is the kind of mind that we have, right? Disordered, confused, scattered, hyperactive, rushing about, right? Finding it difficult to focus, and easily prone to distraction, well, then it becomes very, very difficult for us to get past the surface of things, right? So I think it's within everybody's experience that distractions take us away from our depth, right? Either they prevent us from engaging the depth altogether, or having found the depth, they immediately pull us out of it or away from it, right? And they remove us not simply from the depth, but from the place of the heart. They pull us out from the core of our being, the core of our body. And St. Gregory Palamas calls the heart, he has a great phrase, he calls the heart the body within the body. Right? So there's the body, but in the body there's another body, in a sense, another core. And distractions pull us away from that place and send us into a kind of exile. Right? And if we exist in a realm of distractions, if we allow ourselves to be led about by one sensation and then another sensation, and to be, right, just pulled about in this direction and that direction, it'll become increasingly difficult to get back to that body within the body. Right? We end up living outside of ourselves, and we can actually become oblivious of the fact that we have a depth. Right? There are many people whose lives are very superficial and they haven't understood. They don't know their own the depth of their own being. And somebody once said that the original sin of the mind is distraction. Right? I mean, had Adam and Eve, let's say, been able to stay focused on what they were told and what the program was, right, we wouldn't be here. In the form that we now find ourselves. And, how many times do you get up to, you're sitting in your office and you get up to go get something or do something, and before you get there, you forgot what it was? Right? Right? Easily distracted. What was I, you know, you're opening the refrigerator and, you know, what did I come here to get? Or how many times, you know, you arrive at some sort of state of conviction about something and you feel strong about it, and you're going to go out there and, you know, set the world on fire, and you walk out of the house, open the door, close the door behind you, then you forget exactly, you know, before you get to the car, you forgot what it was that, right? Right, so this is the existential sort of cognitive state that we find ourselves in, and it prevents us from, as I said, attending to the depths. It leaves us somewhere on the surface of things. Now, we have to take this a step further. Why? Because in addition to this, I'll call it natural, I mean, in a loose sense, I mean, because it's what we experience as natural now, the disorder and the confusion and the distraction and the fragmentation that comes from that. On top of this kind of general human condition or weakness, what have we done? What have we done? We have built an entire culture of organized distractions, right? I mean, never before in the history of human civilization has there been a culture quite like ours, which is essentially a culture of organized distractions. Right? Try as you will now to focus and to stay on track and to, right? I don't want to say impossible, right? But it's becoming increasingly difficult to penetrate, let's say, this veil of illusions that has been dropped down in front of our eyes and struggle as you might. I mean, it's a struggle now against the whole culture in a sense. And the fact that we are distracted, the fact that we can't focus, the fact that we are fragmented, it's really nobody's fault. I mean, it's not your fault in a personal way. It's the fault of the culture that in which we are socialized. So we shouldn't so much blame individuals for not being able to focus and for having difficulty in their prayer life and so on. We need to look at the larger culture that has created this situation, which is increasingly reinforced by a range of gadgets and devices. Now, I was out of the country for about 10 years, and when I came back, I almost didn't recognize the country that I had left, because this was a period when I left. I mean, people had email, but there were no smartphones, and there were no iPads, and there were no, I mean, laptops were very rare, they were very expensive. And when I came back to the U.S. a couple of years ago, I was amazed at what had happened to society. And I think part of what a culture does is to naturalize itself. It makes you think that, well, no, this is the way things are, and it's normal, and we get used to things. But I wasn't used to any of this. And it was quite, I could tell you lots of anecdotes. We all have our own anecdotes about these things. But it was surprising, and it was also very distressing to see the degree to which we have become, dependent on these technologies that, for the most part, just keep us distracted all the time, right? And we'll say more about this as we go on. In fact, I have a couple of different areas to touch on here. None of this will be unknown to you, but I think it warrants emphasis because I think we have gotten so used to it. Those of us who are older, I mean, remember a time when things were otherwise, but younger people now who are born into this culture now, this will all seem very natural and very normal to them. And I don't think there's anything natural or normal about it. I think it's very unnatural. And as even secular people are beginning to realize, very unhealthy, right? Very unhealthy. So let's just start. I mean, many of us are old enough to remember a time before televisions had remote controls. And if you wanted to change the channel, you had to physically get up from the couch and walk over to the TV set, right? And because we're so lazy, you often ended up watching something you didn't want to watch because you didn't want to get up and change the channel. Well, now, I mean, people have hundreds and hundreds of options on the remote control, whether it's through cable or through some sort of computer programs, and there's just this limitless number of offerings, and people, what's the phrase, channel surfing, right? Click, 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 and this, right, we bounce from one thing to another, right? We can't rest, even in even our entertainments now, which should be recreative in a sense, which should be relaxing, I mean, don't even provide that anymore. And it's not simply that we sort of flit restlessly from channel to channel, right? That even that wouldn't be so bad. But what we see in the places we stop is itself highly fragmented. It took me a while to get used to this when I first saw it, because it was just so crazy and disorienting. We have, so, I mean, you stop at a channel, and there are often these sort of split-screen images. There might be, the screen might be bifurcated, or it might be quartered, and you have, you know, four different people talking at the same time, right? And that took a little getting used to. Then, at the same time, you have a bifurcated or quartered screen that you're looking at. Then you have, I don't know what they call them, do they call them teasers?
Crawler,
yeah, okay. One, two, or three, depending on what you're watching, lines of text moving at different speeds along the bottom of the, right, so you're listening to a conversation about, I don't know, the Winter Olympics or something, then on the bottom there's news about, you know, a boy who fell in a well in Idaho, and then there's something else about, you know, entertainment news and, Right? We're expected, we're honestly expected to attend to this range of chatter, all of which is very superficial and very unimportant. And we're told by the culture now, well, that's called multitasking, and that's a societal virtue now, but I see it as just more fragmentation. I don't think multitasking is a virtue, I mean, beyond a reasonable limit, right? I mean, you should be able to walk and chew gum, like they used to say, but to be able to attend to an increasing and most people who watch the television, now they've got the computer on and the phone is ringing in, right? And then this was the case many years ago when music videos first started to become popular. And I was astounded when I read that in a music video, no single image stays on the screen for more than 3 seconds, right? And I didn't believe it because it didn't seem possible, but I just, you can't count to three before the image changes. And now that style, let's say, that mode, that aesthetic, if it's even an aesthetic, it's an inhuman thing, so how could it be an aesthetic? But that has now, I mean, movies are like this, and television shows are like this, and, right, so because of our ever-diminishing attention spans, you've got to constantly be shifting the kaleidoscope, the phantasmagoria of images, lest we wander away from the screen for a minute and the advertisers lose all their money. And TVs, this is another thing that I just find so distressing and it angers me, and I wonder what is it going to take for the American people to rise up and say, enough, right? TV screens are now ubiquitous. They're in people's cars. I mean, how can that be safe, right? They're in the back seats of cabs. You go to New York City and you've got to go somewhere in the city and it's crazy and there's noise and there are people and you get in the cab and right in front of your face there's a screen, right, with CBS Morning News and the weather and this. It's like, I didn't ask for this, right? And sometimes they're not even easy to turn off if you're allowed to turn them off at all. Buses have television screens in them. When I flew out here from Boston I flew into San Francisco last week. The space in the airplane seat is very small, and right in front of your face, is it even a foot away? I'm not sure. There's a TV screen. Now, fortunately, you can turn it off. But from where I was sitting, right, I could see 10 television screens from my seat alone, right? So even if you choose, people say, well, you don't have to watch it. Well, guess what? You do, because you choose not to watch yours, but then everyone around you has theirs on, right? And it was, and people just, it's amazing how quickly people have adapted to this, right? And I find it very odd and very distressing. I said airplanes. Doctor's offices, I needed to see a doctor a while ago. There was a big television screen in the waiting room, right? Never, God forbid, there should be a moment's rest. Where else? I have seen television screens in elevators in hotels. Have you seen this? Yeah. They put me in a hotel in, I'm sorry? Yeah, well, that's the last one on my list, because that was the last one that I found. They put me in a hotel in New York City, and I got into the elevator, and there was a television screen with CNN or whatever it was, and everyone, of course, is just transfixed, and then the last one was the gas station, right? I mean, I think St. Anthony, one of the sayings of the Desert Fathers, I mean, St. Anthony says that, you know, there will come a time when the whole world will go crazy, and there'll be a small number of people left who are not crazy, and the crazy people will look at them and say, you're crazy, right? So, you know, if the Orthodox Church or if a priest were to get up in his parish and start asking questions about technology, oh, Father, please, you're backwards, or you're medieval, or you're anti-technology, or you're some sort of Luddite, or you're obscurant, right? Right? We're afraid to do that. We're afraid to stand up to the culture. When in fact, there are no shortage of secular thinkers now, people who are not even Christian, who are not theologians, nothing. They are raising red flags, yet we're not, right? Because we live in fear of the dominant culture, I don't know what, which is why I gave you the bibliography so you can see that. I mean, these things are not talked about in the critiques of technology are not readily found in the media, of course. The media is always selling this stuff to us. But there are thoughtful, intelligent voices out there that are ringing the warning bells. And I think it's in our best interest to give heed. So that was the TV. That was the first one. I grew up, we used to read newspapers in the house. And of course, newspapers are harder to find. The rise of the internet has had a very negative impact on journalism, as I'm sure many of you know. Well, try reading a newspaper online. Try reading a newspaper online. And the text of the newspaper is literally surrounded by various advertisements, all of them screaming for your attention. I mean, there are dancing figures over here. There's a leopard covered with diamonds for Bulgari over there. There are, right? I mean, and you're trying to focus. Now they have, they create ever new methods of attracting your attention. Now they have, I've seen this peel down page. You try to read something and the text is shifting with the advertisements, and it's like, well, yeah, it's a struggle just to be able to focus on, right, the text that's in front of you. And I think that the result of this is to scatter our attention, right? To scatter our attention, to diffuse our concentration, and to blunt, right, the quality of our awareness and perception. Right? It's very hard to focus now. It was never easy to focus, but it's harder now than ever because of the technologies that we're talking about here. Another one, email, can be very distracting, and guess what? Very addicting. Very addicting. Psychologists have shown that the psychological dynamic at work in email is pretty much the same dynamic that's at work in a slot machine, right? And the way the slot machine works is that you sit there and you keep feeding it with quarters or whatever it is, dollars, even though you know that most times this is going to come up all lemons, right? But you sit there and you keep feeding the machine in this hope that you're going to hit the jackpot, right? So they say the same, so it becomes addictive from that point of view. They say the same dynamic is operative in email. You're always checking your email, right? Even though you know that most often it's just lemons, right? It's either an advertisement or it's nothing critical. It's nothing that, you know, well, let me interrupt this important conversation we're having so I can check my email because, well, I don't know, maybe it's the patriarch, right? Right? And that's not been the case for me so far. So right, so you have a message, you have new mail, or the bell goes off. It's very Pavlovian, isn't it? Right, and right away you check. Right away you check, and it doesn't matter where you are or who you're with. You will check that thing because you've become addicted to it, and there's the hope that well this is the message I've been waiting for. It's the Archbishop. He's going to call me into his office and give me that promotion. And I'm going to, what I don't know what it is, whatever we think it is, right? So there's something inherently addictive about email. And email itself is already passé for a lot of people. It's text messaging. And the further fragmentation of text messaging is sort of the Instagram thing now. It's not even waste time with words. It's all reduced to images and pictures. A while ago, I read a book, it should be on the bibliography, called The Tyranny of Email, and a very sensitive sort of essay. The argument here is that language is a beautiful and profound thing. The ability that human beings have to communicate with one another is a fascinating, mysterious, beautiful, and I mean, think about the Desert Fathers, who we've mentioned a couple of times, that say a word, right? It's not text me a message or send me an Instagram or this. Bring forth a word from your inner depth so that I might receive something life-giving, right? And the essay, The Tyranny of Email, argues that email, first of all, debases communication and it imposes very narrow constraints on both the message sender and the message receiver because it reduces the range of communication to a very narrow kind of medium. Right, a small number of words. How often do you get, well, it's too much to talk about an email, we say. It's too long for an email message, and right? So right away, there are things that we can't, you know, the important things, there's a sense in which they're not for the email. And you send me an email message now, and I feel the pressure to respond. You were probably, you felt pressure to send me something, and now the clock is ticking, and they've actually done studies of this, and I think it's down to something like 11 seconds in the corporate world. If you don't respond to an email in 11 seconds, you run the risk of insulting somebody or losing a contract, or then you get the other, hey, did you get my message I sent you, right? So communication now is being forced, right? We're being forced to say things that we wouldn't say at all or that we would normally say otherwise, and I'm now being forced to respond either prematurely or thoughtlessly, or right? I mean, there's no need to spell all of this out because it's all part of our experience now. So think about, speech, language, logos. There's something about the word and our words that are innately connected to the divinity, right? To God himself, who is the word. I remember years ago, from reading the life of St. Francis of Assisi, this is sort of in the late Middle Ages, when before printing and certainly before electronic and digital technologies, and St. Francis is walking down the road and he sees some bits of paper on the side of the road and there's writing on them. And he stops and he picks up the pieces of paper and he tucks them into his pocket because words are important things. Words are powerful things, right? I thought, oh my goodness, that we take language for granted. But here was someone who had this very deep sensitivity to the logos, to language, to the medium. I mean, our soul speaks to soul through the medium of language. That's a very, very profound thing. There's a recent English translation of the life of St. Simeon, the new theologian, and it says that I had never seen this before, that when he was done reading from Scripture, he would press his eyes to the page so that his eyes would touch the words on the page of the book in the way that you see people do with icons. They'll kiss the icon, they'll put their head to the icon. And here we have the words are icons, aren't they, right? They're verbal representations of meanings, not visual representations, right? And we've lost that sensitivity because words and language have been debased largely due to the technologies that we're talking about here. Or how about if you go back to the whole Socratic ideal and this whole idea of doing philosophy through conversation, the whole idea of dialogue, dialogos, right? There's logos again. And for Socrates and Plato too, it wasn't the case that I have the truth and you don't, so you have to sit and listen to me and I impart it to you. The idea was that truth was something that existed much more, how can I put it, that was much more democratic in a sense, that two or more people had to come together. And through this dialogos, through dialogue, through the give and take of ideas, and through the exchange, or through communication, through conversation, that the logos of truth would emerge from that encounter, which is a much more beautiful, like a synod in a sense. We don't say that any one church father is the beginning and the end of, right? If that were the case, we wouldn't need ecumenical councils. So it's in the conciliar context that, and the conversations, which includes debates and quarrels and these kinds of things, it's through that encounter that the word of truth can emerge or arise. And I thought too, during Lent, which is fast approaching, I think we read the prayer of St. Ephrem 8 times a day if you do all of the services. And part of that prayer says, give me not a spirit of idle chatter, argolohia. And what is so much of our communication electronically these days, if not a lot of idle chatter? I mean, the media, the gadgets that we have enable a lot of communication. There's a lot of communication going on. But what is the nature of what is being communicated? What is the quality of that communication? Right? It's often the case that less is more, right? And more is sometimes nothing at all. I could say more here. I don't know how much this is of interest, but in the book by Mark Bauerlin that's on the bibliography, I think it's called The Dumbest Generation, he reports that the shift to reading online, right, from books to online reading, that this shift to online reading has begun to impact the way we read. It's begun to impact the way we read. Why? Because they have eye-tracking devices now that follow the movement of the eye as it reads words on a page in a book and as it reads words on the computer screen. And guess what? We don't read a book the same way. We don't read the words in a book in the same way that we read words on a computer screen. Traditional book reading involves the eye, well, if you're from the Western world, involves the eye reading from right to left, consecutively, line by line by line. That's not how we read information on a computer screen, where I think the pattern is more of like a sort of an F shape, where you read, you look for a heading, and then you sort of jump down and insert the eye goes into the paragraph, which is why everything is bulleted now, all these bulleted items. So because of perhaps part of it is just the sheer quantity of data that we have to get through every day, right? That the eye now is learning to track through text very differently. Now, you can say, well, what's the problem with that? Well, the problem with that is try going back and reading a book after that, right? And those of you who work with younger people, who teach younger people, high school, college, that sort of thing, you will see that it's becoming that this linear way of reading has been compromised, and it's difficult now for a lot of younger people to sit down quietly somewhere with a book and read through it, especially a long right that requires sustained attention, and they're not getting the skills for that, and what they're used to reading really militates against traditional book reading. Maybe one last thing here. I don't want to go on and on about this, but I think worst of all is the so-called smartphone, which I like to call the dumb phone, right? Which is essentially a portable computer, right? When the cell phones were available and people were pulling them out in inappropriate places, you said, imagine if everybody at the dinner table in the restaurant had, remember the old-fashioned phones with the receiver and the cord? Imagine if everybody had a telephone like that at their dinner plate, right? And people would think about is it ludicrous? Is it absurd? Is it insane? What is it, right? Well, that's what we're doing. Doesn't look, we have this sleek, thin design of the cigarette case type, right? So it doesn't quite, but it's the same thing. Well, imagine now those same people without the telephone, but with a laptop sitting on there, next to their table setting, right? And that's, I mean, the other day I was with my family for Thanksgiving, and family members came over for dinner, and everybody came marching to the house with iPads under their arm. It's like, oh, I guess we're not, our company isn't stimulating enough for you. And they literally had these things sitting on the table. And from time to time, you see people are sitting there, right? Like the witch stirring the cauldron or something, or I don't know, whatever they're doing, right? I don't know. It's very rude. It's very divisive. It's destructive of community, right? And again, you might think, okay, well, Father Maximus, you're just some monk. You've been living in a cave somewhere, and you know, welcome to the real world. This is the way it is. That's what the bibliography. The news is that there are a growing number of secular psychologists and theorists. Sherry Turkle, she's on the list. She's a psychologist at MIT. Are offering very, very serious and pointed critiques of this technological culture, because it is just so destructive of attention and concentration and human relation and everything else. So it's not just monastic obscurantism that's saying these things, right? It's something deeper and something much more widespread that we need to be concerned about. Even at the seminary, I see clergy serving the altar with iPads, and they've got their little telephones in there. I mean, this is appalling to me. I mean, a liturgical book is a sacred object. It's a sacred object, right? An iPad is not, right? And it's never going to be. And I suppose if somebody had a dedicated iPad that was for use at the chanting stand and it was not used for anything else, but maybe that might be okay if necessary. But these are the same iPads that people watch movies on. And what kinds of movies, right? They get text messages on, and these things have multiple uses, very few of which are even remotely sacred. Yet we bring that into the sanctuary, right? I mean, it's It's distressing, especially because it's not necessary, right? If you're a priest, learn the apolysis. Learn to come out at the end of the Vesper service and say through the prayer, what, right? And if you don't, if you haven't memorized it, well, open up the book. But to be there with this, you know, I think, how odd, I mean, to see someone in ecclesiastical vestments in the setting of the Byzantine church with this contraption, with this device, with this gadget, it just doesn't. There's some very sort of sad things that you can find on YouTube. Somebody sent me a clip of a clergyman in Greece, and he had come out at the end, I don't know where exactly it was in the service, fully vested in front of the congregation, and he comes out and he says, this is shot. You might laugh, it's okay to laugh because it's a nervous laughter. And he comes out, he starts to make the sign of the cross, and he says, in the name of the Father and the Son, ding, 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 ding. And then he, in the middle of the Trinitarian invocation, pulls out, no, I can't right now, I'll talk to you later, basically. And of the Holy Spirit, right? And this was, and the same technology that distracted him from the invocation of the Trinity is the same technology that captured him on film, right? So the technology creates the problem for you, and then it exposes you to the whole world. So how is this our friend, right? Another anecdote. Last year, I was at a conference in Serbia, in Belgrade. And it was an international conference for St. Maximus the Confessor. And among, it was a wonderful program. One of the many highlights was the consecration of a brand new church dedicated to St. Maximus. It was the first ever church dedicated to St. Maximus in Serbia. And Metropolitan John Zizulis was there as the principal celebrant. There probably were, I don't know, maybe 10 hierarchs and 20 or 30 clergy. And it was a smallish church, maybe no bigger than this room, so it was packed. It was a beautiful day. And at one point prior to the start of the liturgy, somebody came out from the altar, and they said, Father Maximus, the Metropolitan doesn't have his archieratikon. He doesn't have the prayer book that contains the high priestly prayer, the episcopal prayers. They said to me, it was kind of funny, do you have one? Right? I said, well, no, and if I did, I probably wouldn't tell you, right? So, I know, it's a joke I don't travel with, you know what I mean? So I said, sorry, I can't help you on that. So he ran out in a hurry because they needed prayers for the Metropolitan to read. And after a couple of minutes, he comes running back in. I guess he had found a set of these prayers on the internet and came running in with the prayers on an iPad, right? Now, the altar, by the way, is open, so you could see inside the sanctuary. So he comes running into the side of the sanctuary with the iPad, happy that he had found the, and you had to see it. I wish I had caught it on film, right? But as one body, all of the Serbian hierarchs, I mean, took a step back and put their hands up and, right? No, do not bring that object into this space. I mean, it was done even without thinking. The moment they saw, right? So he left, and they printed out the text in the church office, and right. But it was a memorable thing to see that visceral sort of right that response on the part of the hierarchy. That right, it was really a great thing. And then I heard somebody on the radio the other day. They say that the last thing still about the iPhones. The last thing we fondle at night, and the first thing we grope for in the morning, is the iPhone. Right, and the person said, "We have become. This is a Lord of the Rings reference here. We have become nothing as much as Gollum stroking his precious." Right. And if you think about that was the object of his addiction, wasn't it? And it was also think of what it did to him. That the ring sapped him of his life. Right. It sapped it drained the life from him and transformed him from, I don't know what he was before, some human type of a creature, into this really repulsive little creature that he became. So it's also a form of idolatry. I had a lot more to cover, but I don't want to go over the time that I have. The next thing I wanted to talk about, I won't go into, but I'll just mention it, was that had to do with ADD and ADHD, right? Because we have increasing numbers of people that are being diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. And these diagnoses, ADHD diagnoses in children, are up 70% in the last decade for reasons that are unknown, we're told, right? Right? And in 2010, which is the last set of figures I was able to find, in 2010, there were over 10 million cases reported in children, right, for an illness that didn't exist until 1987. Right? 10 million cases for an illness that didn't exist until 1987. And of course, as the result of these 10 million diagnoses, kids at increasingly younger ages are being showered with powerful drugs like Ritalin and Adderall. In other words, brains that have not been fully developed are being sort of bombarded with very, very powerful chemicals. And I had more to say about this, but I think it would take me too far afield. But again, I would say that this is certainly not a disease like the flu, right? Having ADD or ADHD is not genetic. It's not genetic, and which means it's not simply a personal problem. It's a societal problem. It's a societal problem. It's not a condition simply of the self or of a self, but it's a condition of the culture as a whole, right? So I think this first presentation is scheduled. Where's Father Nathan? Come to my, no, 10:15 was the, okay. There's always more to say, but I think I made my point. And just one last thing as a bridge to the next talk that's going to follow. I mean, maybe a series of questions. I mean, so why are we drawn to surface appearances? Right? Why are we so easily distracted? Why are we addicted to surface appearances? You know, might it be, what is it about the depth that, what, frightens us? Right? To talk about the idea of fear we were talking about last night. I mean, are we afraid of the depth? Right? There's something about the surface that we love, obviously, because we're forever running after it and we're forever clinging to it. So what is it about the depth, our own inner depth, that we're afraid of? Are we afraid of something that we might find there? Freud said that, you know, people walk into the room and they put on the radio right away. You get into the car, you put the music on right away. You put the TV on right away. And he said, that's because people don't want to hear, in a sense, their unconscious impulses. So are we running from something? Are we afraid of what we might find in the depth? Or still worse, are we afraid that we'll find nothing in the, right? That we've become essentially hollow, vacuous people living on the surface all the time, and to look into the void of our own nothingness is so terrifying that, well, bring on the distractions, right? Right. I didn't mention the binge watching on Netflix, where you can watch whole seasons of television shows, right? People, they disappear over the weekend because they had to catch up on the last 2 years of, I don't know what, right? I mean, right? 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 So society creates the problem, and then it offers us what it says is the cure. Right? Oh, you're lonely, you're isolated, you're fragmented, you're alienated. And well, sure, because society, the kind of society we live in has made us that way. But society is very kind, so here's the cure. Endless television watching, endless channel surfing, endless distractions will help you cope with all of that inner nothingness by giving you, right, these illusions and these appearances. So it could be the case, have we lived most of our life on the surface or outside of ourselves or far away from ourselves in a fruitless search for meaning and fulfillment in things outside of ourselves? So there's a very deep disconnection, I think, that's taken place here. And we become disconnected from ourselves, which means that we become disconnected from neighbor and above all from God. And there are things that unmoored us from that deeper anchoring. It could be trauma, it could be, I mean, things in our childhood, whatever it was, but all of these things sort of collude together. And this is why, and here's the final point, which is my bridge to the next talk. This is why the church has always emphasized the importance of the inner life, Church is not about appearances. The church is not about superficial surface appearances. The church is always about the depth of things. We don't have photographs of saints in the church, even though we have saints now who lived after the invention of photography, St. Nectarios, most recently St. Porphyrios. We don't consider photographs of these men or women to be suitable for the icon screen. Because even though that's their photograph, it's still the surface. Right? The icon reveals the depth. So the ideal of inner attention, of recalling one's fragmented and scattered attention, right? Of recollecting oneself within the mind and then following the breath to the heart, right? This is the only solution we have for what's happened to our society over the last 10 years. So and that'll serve as the bridge to my next talk. So that brings the first presentation to an end, and